Welcome to the Lovejoy Hour, sponsored by Cooker, 100 degree boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tab. Yes, I have one, and yes, I am living in the future. I have 100 degree boiling hot water on demand. I have chilled filtered water on demand, and I have sparkling chilled filtered water on demand. It is an amazing gadget. For more information, go to cooker.co.uk. Today's Lovejoy Hour will get you thinking. Today's Lovejoy Hour, I'm curious about which nations will dominate and control the world in the future. Big subject, but I have someone who might have the answers. Well, he does quite a lot on it. His name is Peter Frankopan, Professor of Global History at Oxford University, who's written the book, The New Silk Roads. I think it was first written in 2018, updated in 2019. And I imagine he'll have to update it again after the pandemic. Actually, probably with this book, he might have to update it constantly, once a month, once a week. So it's The New Silk Roads and the present and future of the world. Let's meet him. Here's Peter. Hello, Peter. How are you?
Yeah, very, very good. I've got the sun shining outside for a rare occasion, so I'm in very good mood.
Good, good stuff. So I think the first thing we should do is find out a bit about you, what you do on a day-to-day basis. Obviously, you write books, but apart from that.
Okay, so well, I'm a professor of history. So my life has three sort of different branches, I guess, or all professors have three different branches. One is teaching. One is then doing research, so working on whatever project you might be working, and some of those can be really big, some can be really small. And, you know, people, I think that academics spend most of their time having coffee and polishing their leather patches on their tweed jackets, and there's not an enormous amount of time for that. And then the third part of it is doing sort of admin, of making the university work or departments run. And so that's the kind of the day job of any academic. Outside of that, I'm interested in parts of the world that are, as we're going to talk about, that are either on the move or represent challenges, opportunities, and whatever. So there's a whole other life I have as well that is involved in either helping people who are making policy, giving them some sort of context, you know, when there's change, where does that happen and why, or helping play a role in some of those discussions directly. So it's quite a sort of rich tapestry of life. No 2 days are the same.
Yeah.
Which is great.
Let me first of all ask you about university then. During the pandemic, university seemed to break. And I mean, we're still in the pandemic as we speak now, but my daughters went off to university, have not been inside their buildings yet, and still getting charged the money, being told that the universities can't survive without it. I mean, what is going on with universities? It seems, I mean, I personally feel it's bad that we're putting children in debt or youngsters in debt when they don't even get anything. But they're being told that they need to carry on doing it online. Do we see the future of universities changing dramatically?
Gosh, well, that's the one that's going to get me hate mail from listeners and from colleagues. And it's not a simple question. I guess that the bigger question is, you know, what is the role of university? And what university has become, for good and for bad, to a large extent, is an accreditation process. So for your social mobility, if you can wave a certificate saying you've got a degree, that puts you ahead of people in your year group that don't have a degree. And to that extent, the piece of paper has value. For whatever reason, the reason why a lot of people go to universities or their parents are keen from to go to universities is that you kind of feel it's part of the social churn, that if you don't go to university, you're going to slip back socially. And so to that extent, what you study, how do you learn it? It's a separate kind of story. Now, I've got kids who are university themselves and my students. What you read about students in the press is that they're lazy. They sit at home. They don't really care how they listen. The reality is anybody who teaches young people is they're like sponges. You know, they'll pick up everything and anything. And, you know, most of what happens in universities isn't just what some old man with a beard or, you know, some distinguished old woman or man who's been in their position for 45 years. A lot of the university experience is learning from peer to peers, from hearing what other people your age are listening to. So when I was at university, where I met my wife, you know, we would all sit around talking about the ills and the woes of the day, the poll tax riots, the collapse of the Soviet Union. And, you know, we cut that in with all the stuff that was interesting too, football or going out in the evenings. But, you know, a lot of the experience of university is the social side. So even if you could put me in a room, allow all the students back in, you know, actually the most important element, I think, of socialization at university is meeting people from different backgrounds, different countries, different languages, different social groups to what you've grown up with, and being exposed to new things. Mm. So my world is part of the problem, the academics being difficult about how do we teach and how do you learn. But the bigger part of it, I think, is about more related to the pandemic, the kind of restrictions that the government have put on meeting people. So the bit that students have struggled with, I'm sure your kids the same, Tim, in the last year and a half, has been not being able to see each other, not being able to go out in the evenings, not being able to have a drink, and not being able to talk and laugh and unwind and complain about their professors rather than putting me in a room.
Yeah, we could do a whole hour on this, so we'll move it on. But yeah, I think they're bored because they want to get involved in they're both doing, well, one's doing history and politics, one's doing anthropology and politics, and they both want to get involved in discussing it. And I don't think they're able to achieve that in the way it's been set out. Anyway, let's talk quickly about history then. It's a strange question, but is history always moving on? Because you think history can't move, yet obviously you're saying you're researching history. So how much does it move from when we look back and we go, that is history, that's what we're going to teach at school, and then, I don't know, 50 years later we go, actually, that's not what happened, this is what happened. How much does it move?
That's a great question. You know, there are all sorts of ways in which history moves. First, you can find something from the past that no one knew about that makes you have to change what you think. And those can be documents or, you know, bodies that have been buried, archaeological finds. In fact, at the moment, we're living in a world where data sciences are completely transforming, not necessarily what we think, but how we think about the past. So, for example, with climate science, there are ice cores being drilled in glaciers and in places like Greenland, where you can find out lead particulates that show you what industrial production was like in ancient Rome. And so when we think about ancient Rome, it's about emperors shagging or murdering each other or being looking at Russell Crowe. But, you know, the question, a very simple one, which is how much wood was needed to be burnt to create pieces of glass and make coins and build houses? How did the Romans deal with changing environmental stress? And did they cope with that kind of stuff well? So that doesn't necessarily change the shagging and the emperors and the murders, but it does change, I think, what kind of questions we ask. So history is partly about what questions are being asked backwards. Sometimes it's about new discoveries. Sometimes it's about whole new availabilities of data, but also some of it, you know, in the past, history used to be about great men. You know, that was the sort of the story you follow from the top. In today's world, you know, we think always about society probably from the bottom upwards rather than what rich leaders do and how much of their decisions shape societies. So I think it's not that it changes, although occasionally you can have these kind of sudden experiences and sudden pieces of information that transform stuff. But it's about asking more interesting and more nuanced questions. I mean, in fact, in my own particular case, I work on part of the world that no one pays any attention to. So it's not the history's changed, it's no one has ever bothered to ask about it. So you'd have done like I did 3 or 4 times the Tudors at school. So we can all name the wives of Henry VIII. No one ever told me why that was important, or did it teach me that, you know, that Henry VIII could be a good king but a bad husband, or maybe he was a bad king. I mean, no one would say he was a good husband, right? But I never kind of understood why I was learning about that. Whereas the stuff that I'm interested in is, you know, well, what is the history of places like Turkey? You know, why is China currently in the position it's in? What's its past? I never heard a word about that in the classroom, about the history of other parts of the world. And clearly right now, you know, in the kind of Black Lives Matters world, in the global Britain kind of world, and the sense of big problems need global solutions from health to climate, knowing about other parts of the world, Africa, South America too, they're all left off the curriculum. So it's not that history changes, it's that we start to think of things that are interesting that maybe we didn't think about before.
And I also assume there's some confirmation bias going on and what you're looking for. Obviously, white people want to be dominant, and they did back in history's time, I assume. And also, I also assume you've got religions and royal families or our class system trying to project their dominance, their superiority on the world by showing history from their view. I mean, like, to keep the royal family for all these years is absolutely been incredible. And also to keep religions with science coming along for all these years is also unbelievable too. In my mind, I can never get my head around it.
But it depends what you think. You know, I'm not in a position to judge what it is that people think when they on their hands and knees praying to their God, right? But, you know, I'm also aware that religion serves all sorts of other purposes. And, you know, there's no question that social structures are significant. I mean, that's not the kind of history that I work on. At the moment, I'm working on walnuts, and the walnut shells can show you about how people were trading across the spine of Asia.
But what I'm saying is, I don't have religion, so I look at these things, and I'm not a royalist. I'm not sure what I think about that at the moment. I'm just exploring it a lot. But why not? When I look at these things, especially with, let's take religion for instance, they have to have their versions of history to sustain the religion, don't they? And I mean, you obviously talk about that in your books with Christianity and Islam being passed through the Silk Roads. So this is obviously something where history throughout time, I assume, has this version of events. So Jesus and his version of events have stayed in the Christian world for quite a long time because it serves a purpose.
I don't think it's so hard for you to understand, Tim. You know, you're a Chelsea fan like me, right? And your version of the 1980s is not wrong, right? It's not necessarily threatening even to a Spurs fan. It is what it is. You know, your focus, your devotion, the players that you venerated, maybe down at the shed end, they're slightly different to the people who are the match with you. John Bumpstead, whoever it might, Gary Chivers, you might rate them higher or lower. And, you know, it's a very benign process. It can kick off. But, you know, when it kicked off in the 80s, it wasn't really about football and tribalism. It kicked off because people wanted to have a fight about other stuff. Right. So religions can be looked back on and overused by historians who make it all look like it's the fault of people who are so devoted that they must be thick. But by and large, you know, people who kick off aren't thick. You know, they do it for a reason. And there are other things that are involved in it. So your faith, your identity, the sociability, the wanting to be similar to all the people around you, whether it's in a cathedral or in a football ground, you know, it's about, you know, why do you choose to have an identity? And, you know, why do people choose to become Chelsea fans who come in from all over the country at the week? And I'm only choosing Chelsea, right? We should probably broaden it to not eliminate all your other fans who aren't Chelsea supporters. But, you know, when we choose sociability and we choose to belong to groups, that's a conscious decision. It's sometimes fluid and it's quite subtle, you know, so you can be an England fan or a Scotland fan, as well as a Chelsea fan. You know, when Man U are playing against Man City, you can pick a side that's, you know, you just feel that you want them to win. Sometimes that's to do with self-interest and wanting the points to go to another team. But I think religions can be like that too. So they get given a lot of grief by people who want to use religion as a way of scoring their own points about God or about belief or their own dislike of people who talk about God and their beliefs and whatever. But actually, the more interesting thing is about why do people want to have identities that are in common? Why do they want to project ideas about themselves? And how do they do that? And a lot of it is more benign than some historians give it credit for. But, you know, it's a bloody story for sure. Mm.
I suppose the point I'm trying to make here is when you're learning history, we're learning it from our point of view, our perspective. And I only noticed this when I went to Russia, and their view of the Second World War seems to be, I was speaking to sort of youngish sort of people who were talking about the Second World War. I mean, I don't have any friends who discuss the Second World War really now. I mean, my parents love to, but people don't. And they were talking about how they won the Second World War because they were the ones who lost the massive amount of men. Yet when we're learning about history in this country, we're learning about Britain and America, aren't we, really? That we won the war. And so I'm wondering, from historic point of view, when you're looking at the Silk Roads and things like that, there's obviously the British version of it, which we're taught, and then there's the version from Turkey and China and Russia and, you know, all the Middle East, isn't there? And do they have a different version of it? Is that when you're researching?
More Kazakhs died in the Second World War than Brits. You know, we don't think about that at all, you know. So I think that the tellings of the past, you know, it's right that everyone looks, I mean, it's normal that people look at things from their own perspective. You know, that's absolutely how we think about the world around us. We start with your own house and then you look at your neighbours and then your region, et cetera, et cetera. And I suppose like concentric circles, it depends how far you're willing to let that go in terms of what you think is important to you. But, you know, I think that it's important to understand other people have different perspectives, you know, and listening to them. The challenge is that if no one tells you that more Kazakhs died in the Second World War than, for example, people in Britain, then it doesn't mean that makes us braver or less brave. It doesn't mean they won the war, we won the war, in the kind of simple who did worst or who did best. But I think it's to understand these global stories that there are reasons why people want their voices to be heard. And if you get excluded from the past and that Second World War, which drifts off into, you know, where Eagles Dare territory, where we think where the Brits are all like, you know, proto James Bonds, very, very cunning and very smart at working things out, these plots, you know, you can forget the reality and you start to sort of project myths backwards about the Blitz spirit. And you know, you see that even though your friends don't talk about the Second World War, that is what always gets put on the front pages of the tabloids when we get through to semi-finals or we play football tournaments. It's a kind of lodestone that makes us think this is the bit where we had our backs against the wall. We did it during the pandemic. You know, we did it in the World War II, so we can survive the pandemic. And we hark back to these kind of stories. And I do think it's important to not necessarily correct those, but to put them in context, to say every country's had their back against the wall. Everybody's had challenges. And in fact, maybe the more important one is that human beings can be quite resilient, as well as bloodthirsty and violent, et cetera, et cetera. So that in a way, the perspective you take is to pull geography out of the story and to stop thinking that we're exceptional and to think that we're the only people who've ever managed to come, you know, pluck victory from the jaws of defeat. You know, lots of peoples, I mean, all peoples have done that. It's just when that happened and on what scale.
So how stable is the world at the moment? Interestingly, talking about my daughters and my parents in this conversation right away, I've discussed this a few times on my podcast. Lovely. We're very politically engaged as a family. And what's lovely is looking at the different generations. My children are all for, they think the world's quite peaceful. They're for disarmament, nuclear disarmament, and shrinking the armies even more, the forces even more. My parents want to ramp it up. My mum was evacuated in the Second World War. She doesn't trust our neighbours and keeps saying, you lot have got very short memories. On your books, when I'm reading the new Silk Roads, you know, there is a power shift going on in the world. How safe are we in Britain at the moment, do you think?
Well, it depends what safe means. I mean, you know, the last 30 years has been, despite Afghanistan and Iraq and Libya, you know, and there have been, and Tigray and Ethiopia, you know, there have been flashpoints that have cost thousands, in fact, tens of thousands of lives, Syria likewise. You know, as a global community, the last 30 years, this has been one of the most peaceful and unusual moments in global history, you know, where people who've got nuclear weapons haven't used them. We've all got the capacity to inflict massive damage on each other. And in fact, most of it is carried out by people shouting in the newspapers. So people who listen to the news get scared because they think this is terrifying. But, you know, you and I grew up in a world where when I was my kid's age, the question was not, would there be a nuclear war? It would be, when would there be a nuclear war? Yep. You know, it was absolutely guaranteed in the 70s and 80s that at some point something would go wrong or there'd be an escalating crisis. So I feel considerably safer today than I did then. You know, we occasionally used to have drills about, you know, what would you do if bombs came raining down? And you know, I think that we can kid ourselves that things are more chaotic and difficult and fractious than they really are. You know, actually, the resilience and the cooperation have been quite impressive in the last 30 years. Now, whether that goes forward depends on what you make of what's going on in the world, how stressed you feel by that shift, and whether you think that shift is bad for you. But, you know, clearly people who are who feel that they're under pressure tend to make different kinds of decisions than people who are planning for prosperity and planning for the future. You know, you think the world's going to get better, you'll save, you'll invest, you know, you'll build. If you're scared, you'll start to hoard things, you'll start to assume the world is coming to an end. And, you know, this pandemic has been quite a good dummy run, I think, in resetting some of those expectations. You know, when we have future pandemics, everybody who's alive today will know what it means to be locked down. They'll know what it means to have to socially isolate. And, you know, people have taken different views about how lethal this disease is. But in the future, if it's worse, you know, we'll have been through it. So these kinds of episodes are quite useful, I think, in terms of sanitizing the fact that we're quite lucky, you know, despite the fact your daughters haven't been able to speak to their lecturers and the, you know, all the mental health stuff that's really serious, particularly for younger people, but for everybody too, you know, we've got through it more or less intact, and things could have been a lot, lot worse, both in terms of this pandemic, but also global. So things can go wrong very quickly. You know, I tell my students, it took one guy on a street in Sarajevo 100 years ago to shoot two bullets that started the First World War. Now, historically, that may not be exactly quite as simple as what happened. So, but sometimes a straw can break the camel's back. So the question is, do we think we're in a trigger moment where we're on the point of global nuclear war? And it would seem to me that the wind is blowing a little bit, but it could be a lot, lot worse.
Yeah, but we're in a situation where economic dominance is changing, isn't it? America, I mean, I was looking at the companies. America's still got the majority of the top 10 companies in the world, haven't they? Even though the Saudi energy companies Aramco is up there in second place. But there's a couple of Chinese ones who have entered the game in this top 10. But America is still dominant, aren't they, globally? They're still the big force, aren't they? Or is it changing dramatically, do we think?
Yeah, I think they are. You know, it's not the biggest economy by PPP, by sort of, but, you know, depending how you measure it. China is obviously growing very fast, but, you know, average income in China is about $10,000. And in the US, it's 3, 4, or even 5 times that, depending which data you look at. So America is by far the biggest economy, and it grows quickly and drives, you know, the tail that wags the global dog, you know, no question about that. So I think the US is pretty resilient and does well. But the problem is when you open the newspapers or you look at the world around you and you see companies from other parts of the world that are growing, it's not immediately clear to me that that's a bad thing if I'm living in London or in Oxford. It's not necessarily clear to me that's a bad thing if I'm living in Silicon Valley or in New York, you know. So I think it's that, and in any event, those global companies have shareholders from all over the world. You know, Aramco, as for example, only has 5% of its stock available to buy and sell. The rest of it's all owned by Saudi Arabia. So when we think about the companies, where they're hosted, where their home is, you know, does it matter about their shareholders or about their users? So 75% of Facebook's earnings are not made in the United States or in Europe. Facebook makes all of its money, makes the vast majority of its money in Asia. So although it's a US listed company, or it's run by Mark Zuckerberg and he's the dominant shareholder, you know, the consumers, the customers, the people who are generating profits are living in other parts of the world. So I think we just got to be careful when we think about global markets and global trade and businesses, to not think, well, if you're based in London or you're based in one country, that makes you British or that makes you whatever. In fact, in my view, a lot of these global companies, particularly in the United States, act against the interests of the US. And that's clearly one of the things that Trump and now Biden are trying to get at. You know, if you're a business, your job is to reduce your tax liabilities as low as you legally are able to. And so for companies like Pfizer or Apple, you put you put hundreds of billions of dollars offshore just to keep them out of the way of being taxed, because you don't want your cash to come back into the US system. And you do that in a completely legal way. But that's not necessarily in the interests of the United States and United States citizens. Equally, if you have your kit assembled in China or in Vietnam or in Mexico or in India, and jobs leach out of the US system, that may not be that's in the best interest of consumers, because it means your phones are going to be cheaper to buy. But actually, if you're not providing jobs back home, that can be complex too. So I think this is it's a complex world where I think we just got to be careful not to think that the rise of one is bad and that that's coming at our expense. It's all going hand in hand and tandem.
What do you think of Trump? Do you think he was... is he seeing a future? I mean, is he seeing a dominance from China and Russia and everyone in his own country, well, China especially, in his own country? And did he see that? And that's what that's what he did play on. But is he seeing something?
I think Trump was obviously, despite the poison and the bullying and the lack of willingness to listen, was trying to, you know, you can see what the questions were he was trying to solve, which was US jobs. And to some extent, Biden is continuing the Trump plan on that, which is to bring more jobs back to the US. The rise of China that he could see was coming, and it's been obvious in the US for the last 20 years, but to try to recalibrate that trading relationship and the military balance he was trying to do. But the problem is that Trump, like a bull in a china shop, for all the things he was trying, you can understand what he was trying to do. The way he did it was chaotic. He alienated American allies. And then probably worse is that he constantly overpromised and underdelivered, and that upset and unsettled countries that are closer to China geographically, you know. So I think that that there's always method in the madness, and you can't get to become president of the United States if you're a complete moron, despite what the media here think and the sort of intelligentsia. You know, that Trump was appealing, you know, 77 million people voting for him. You know, a bit like the Brexit debate, whatever side you're on, you've got to recognize, you need to listen to what it is your opponents are saying if millions of people think that they're right. And I think we switched that off quite quickly with Trump. But the way in which he tried to do it, and the chaos and the backtracking that he did was hopeless. But I mean, you could see what the major challenges that he was trying to address. And, you know, because he's a bully and because he got, you know, understood how the media works, he was in some ways quite effective. But that came at the price of splitting the country in two. And on balance, that may not be the best thing that you want in democracy, to antagonize and set off half a country against the other half. So Biden's real job right now is not to deal with China, it's not to deal with climate, it's not to deal with energy or American jobs, it's to heal that rift and to try to work together with people on different sides. And politicians in the US have learned that you get a lot of traction if you're just constantly attacking very aggressively the other side and doing personal attacks, which is what Trump specialized in. And you know, that's not really helpful. You know, it's the same here in the UK, regardless of your political persuasion. You want to have a good opposition that holds the government to account. You want to have a government that is pushed by an opposition to improve its performance. And if it just becomes a tribal story, you know, then it's fans of opposing teams kicking off with each other rather than thinking about, you know, is it a good game? And you may be different to me, Tim, but, you know, I think a really good 3-2 defeat, I'll take that if Chelsea played really well.
Yeah.
If it was a great game. And I'll sit there in the pub being upset about it. But I'd love that any day,
yeah,
rather than a sort of rubbish draw and violence in the stands. But sometimes we forget that beautiful game. And I've definitely got friends of mine, you know, my sons, for example, they are not interested in watching non-Chelsea teams, you know, and they will cheer for a rubbish 1-0 win by Watford against Spurs, rather than saying, you know, wouldn't you love to see a fantastic series of goals and so on. And I think global politics can be like that too. You know, we want the best outcome rather than the best theater. And I think that's really important to remember.
I'm sick of politics in this country, and I think I speak for a lot of people here, that the idea that the whole of your idea of what your party is just attacking the other party is so dull now for us all, but it seems to work for them. But the opposition now have become so nothingy with their too little, too late, too little, too late. I've got no ideas, but you're too little, too late. It's like, come on, Keir, show us a future, you know, have some form of, I don't know, plan. Just sell us a plan, for God's sake, you know? Anyway.
Do you know what's worse than being sick of it? Is it doesn't work. You know, so in my lifetime, and I don't really include Harold Wilson in 1974 when I was 3 years old, but Tony Blair is the only Labour politician to lead Labour to a victory. And so you'd think if you get it wrong that many times, you lose that many matches.
Yeah,
you keep changing the manager, but maybe the tactics need to be changed. You need to play to your strengths rather than the other way around. And like I said, regardless of my political persuasion, you know, you need to have a good opposition that is going to have a vision that it's not trying to do down the other side, it's just trying to make the country better. And I think when you have a weak opposition, or one that fights with itself very effectively, which Labour Party unfortunately does, it means that those who are in power don't get stretched. And then we're talking during the Olympics, it's exactly that you need strong competition to push you to excel. And you know, we know that on the sports field, which I keep using as an analogy, but sport, you know, politics should be like that too. You know, you should want to see a good result. You should want the Prime Minister to be the best, to do the best they can. If we've got Boris Johnson for the next few years, then we've got him, but he needs to be pushed, held accountable, and made to improve the country in the best possible way. And you can't do that if the house is burning elsewhere. You know, people are arguing with each other about things that don't really matter. So I'm not surprised you say you're sick of it, but you know, it does us down at a time when we're living through global change to be asleep at the wheel.
We're in the middle of a pandemic. Boris Johnson's lying constantly, but it doesn't matter, because there's nothing can come of it. So we can just carry on. Look, getting back to the Silk Roads, if I've got it right, so the Silk Roads, we all know, you know, a trading route from Asia through to Europe. Then sort of, did it sort of disappear for a while? And now you're saying that it's come back stronger, this whole region.
Well, so the Silk Roads is a kind of nice label that was thought up about 150 years ago to explain trade from China to the Mediterranean. And there's no sort of road, there's no like motorway network. It's just a sort of series of connections. And in fact, most connections, you know, like starting with your history, they tend to be local. You know, we tend to have our most intensive engagements with our neighbors, you know, the corner shop where you buy your milk every day, you know, your neighbors who you see kicking a ball in the park. And then you travel and you see things that are further away. So the Silk Roads, most trade was local and from place to place and village to village. But some high luxury objects went the whole way from east to west, but also from west to east. So 2000 years ago, you had traders complaining in Rome about the price of Indian fabrics and spices. And you had Indians complaining about the fact that Romans tried to drive their money too hard for their, you know, try to get too much money for too much goods for their cash. And so over that intensive connections of exchange, that's how, you know, trade, but also religion spread. So Christianity spread not from Europe outwards, but from Asia. You know, that's where Jesus Christ lived and born, etc. Born and lived, etc. Spread towards Europe and also across into Asia. And in fact, Christianity spread much more quickly into Asia. So until about 1400, there were more Christians living in Asia than there were in Europe. So Islam did the same thing, spread partly through conquest, partly through accommodation, partly through tax breaks and good financial planning. Buddhism likewise. And so the way in which that world was all has been interconnected has been very intensive for 2000 years. Where that really changed was that Europe until about 1500 was at the wrong end of everything. So Rome was a kind of unusual exception. And in fact, it built its power by controlling parts of Asia. You know, we don't think about that because Rome is Italy. And we think that what Europe means is Spain, Italy, France and Germany and Britain. You know, that's the engine room. But Rome's real anchor was set in the Eastern Mediterranean, in places like Syria and in places like Judea and in what's now Turkey and even in Iraq. And the trade all came from the east, you know, of luxury goods. Where that all changed was in about 1500, Columbus made it across the Atlantic, and then a Portuguese explorer called Vasco da Gama made it round Africa, the southern tip of Africa, to India. And suddenly Europe found itself in the middle of all these continents and worked out how to exploit resources through extraction of silver, etc., through slaughter of, you know, managed to take money back from the Incas, the Aztecs, etc. They managed to enslave populations in West Africa, particularly in South Africa too, and ship them across the Atlantic to work for free. And then Europe for the last 300 years or so became dominant. So that meant that those connections across Asia didn't become unimportant. It just meant that their goods found other ways to get to consumers. So they were brought by the Dutch and the Portuguese, eventually by the British. And, you know, the British Empire was built by controlling those maritime Silk Roads and by taking out those squares on the kind of board of monopoly that were really valuable. You know, the jewel in Britain's crown was India, and Britain's role of controlling oil in the Middle East was the story of the 20th century alongside the First and the Second World Wars. So they've always been crucial and important. It's just the last 300-400 years, Europe has had this very unusual period of global dominance and of economic power. And that looks to me that that's changing. You know, when Theresa May became prime minister, she said it's time for Britain to reach its most glorious moments in history. And that would take most historians by surprise, given that 100 years ago, Britain controlled a quarter of the world's population. But the idea that we might be ready to do that again. And it came at the cost of slavery, oppression, etc. But, you know, maybe we've got a future ahead. But it would look to me more likely that large populations, demographics, economies, etc. are where the action is. But that European experience has meant that we switched off our history. So at school, you'd have learned about the Romans in Britain, then a 1,000-year gap until Battle of Hastings, then a 500-year gap until Henry VIII, fat lad and his wives, and then the Victorians. But you didn't hear anything about the rise of Islam. You didn't hear anything about the Chinese dynasties. You didn't hear anything about the Aztecs or the Incas or the Puebloans. You didn't hear anything about the kingdoms of Ghana and Benin, etc. And I think that is now changing because these people have all got very rich and proud histories. And as they become more important and also more challenging as well, you know, their histories become more center stage. It's a long answer to a very good question. Did they dip? They've always been part of these connections, have always been what's made the world tick together. So they're like veins and arteries in the human body. Superficially, you know, it all looks like it's all about Europeans and white people, but that's never been the case. And it's only very recent in the grand scheme that has been.
So there is a shift recently, isn't there? I mean, you do a good example in the new Silk Roads. It's about the Premier League, going back to your football analogies, how the Premier League now, a lot across the Midlands is owned by China. Then you've got the Saudis who own Man City, and you've got Russian-owned Chelsea. So there's some new dominance happening in our football. Then obviously we've got some American owners of some of the big clubs like United and Liverpool. Very few British owners anymore of the Premier League. But all these people have come in. Why have they come in to own our clubs? I mean, I assume China is different from Russia because Russia is a single man, whereas China is a country.
I think it's different in each case. But, you know, as a Chelsea fan, I mean, I have slightly mixed feelings about it. With dear old Ken Bates and his checkbook that, you know, and now when you look at the Chelsea players, every single one of them is an international for a major team in the world. And they're world class, you know, the way that they play, you know, it's just a completely different game to Mickey Droy and Chopper Harris charging up from central defence. And so the reasons why people buy it, it's all multiple. Sometimes it's because if you've got that much money, you might as well have a bit of fun. that could be the story about Abramovich, why he bought Chelsea. Some because it's very important presentationally for your state to show what you do. So the Qataris who bought Paris Saint-Germain and the Sovereign Wealth Fund, or the UAE ruling family that control Manchester City, it's about boosting connections. And some of that's done through cross-marketing of airlines and destinations and so on. But some of it is about your pride. You know, if you're that rich, you might as well spend it on something. And some of it is about trying to work out, can you squeeze money out of a global audience, which would seem to be what John Henry and Liverpool are doing, and the Glazers at Man U, working out that we live in this global community. And if you can sell rights of TV, of shirt sponsorship, of soft drinks and whatever into a global world, then you can make a lot of money from it. So those football teams, I think, are quite a good cipher to explain how the world has changed. But it's not just the owners, it's the players too. You know, we have fully, properly globalized global football teams. And so I did something a while ago, and I was asked about what's the best example I could give of globalization. And football, it does come back to me quite quickly. And I said, you know, it's Didier Drogba, Ivory Coast centre forward at Chelsea, a club owned by a Russian, wearing a shirt made in China. And I saw a kid on the street in Peru wearing, you know, Drogba number 9 on the back. And you go, every single person in the world who's interested in football knows who Didier Drogba is and knows that whole sort of layer of complexity. And in fact, the only bit that we provide is a geographical location that he plays at Stamford Bridge. So, you know, I think that the question is that bad? You know, who is it bad for? As a Chelsea fan, I'm thrilled. If I was a young Chelsea Academy player, I'd probably be a bit more edgy that I wouldn't get a chance to play. But on the other hand, I then get farmed out to a less good team and I earn my Spurs. That's not the worst way of doing it either, you know. And but, you know, even looking, watching the Euros this summer, when the ball's out of play, all the sponsors around the side, it's Qatar Airlines, it's Hikvision, which is a big Chinese high-tech company, it's Alipay, which is one of the big Chinese fintech companies. And, you know, that's changed. And it's not about, is that a good thing or is it a bad thing? I mean, it'd be great if Sainsbury's want to sponsor it, or if, you know, Harrods or whatever business you want. But that's, I think, a reality of how global finance moves. So there are lots of reasons why individuals buy clubs. Some, I guess, is personal passion. Some is about showcasing different things. And some of it is about working out there's a good business here.
I get that, but if you're an American company and you're an American person, you're buying into a football club, that's one thing. If you're, let's just part Russia to one side, because I don't really understand Russia at all, and I'm slightly uncomfortable with Roman, if I'm really honest with you, where he's got his money from and all the influences of those oligarchs. But if you look at China, we all know China is run by the Chinese Communist Party. There's no such thing as individual companies in China. They pretend they are. But the reality is China own everything. The state owns everything. That is how communism works.
It's a bit more nuanced than that. So there are private companies, but what communism means that the phone could ring and then you don't own it anymore. So you're fine. You can run whatever you like. All these companies will have a Communist Party report on them all the time.
Yeah.
If you cross somebody's desk, or someone doesn't like you, or you've done something wrong, then suddenly everything's up for grabs and there's no protection. And that's a different system.
But also the Chinese Communist Party, as I understand it, have put money into companies which look like they're not going to be a commercial success, but they think, let's fund that because it looks good on the world. So it's not the same game as America are playing. Right. So the question is, what is their game? What are China trying to do at the moment? Because we look at them as the bad people at the moment in the world, aren't they? They're the new enemy because they're buying up everything and just invading everybody's economies. They bought up Africa. They're buying up everything. What are they trying to achieve?
Well, I think it's very heavily separated depending on which region, which sector, which person, which company. And I think the danger is to think that there's a kind of single giant monster squid that controls all of its tentacles. You know, in some cases, the reason why people buy clubs, not just from China, but from other parts of the world too, is to get cash out of their home country. And in China, where you've got a state that can intervene quite aggressively into your assets, buying clubs, buying £100 million apartments in London or New York, wherever it might be, is a way of getting cash away from the system. And I think that happens in Russia, that happens in the Middle East too. It's to make sure that your assets are being diversified. So there are lots of reasons why it is that people will buy stuff. Football clubs, just part of it. I think with China, there are sectors that are of high and extreme interest to the Communist Party and to the sort of central mainframe. And those typically sit around things like energy, defense, digital, where there is very high levels of supervision football clubs, I think, slightly different. I think that to start with, some of the Chinese acquisitions were about showing that Chinese entrepreneurs are so successful and so rich that they can go and buy trophy assets in other people's countries, and football clubs, one of those too. But, you know, we don't have to sell in the UK. You know, the Newcastle wasn't allowed to be sold to the Saudis for that reason. The problem is that if Chinese buyers are there to buy things, then it's at what level should governments be protecting industries or sectors and not allowing them in? But, you know, China's got three or four obvious long-term challenges. One is about food supply. One is about energy. One is about environmental stress. And so some of the things that China is doing is about trying to plan in advance to cope with some of those challenges. And some of those interventions are quite aggressive. But we, I think, being asleep at the wheel and not thinking about it, have woken up really quite late to asking two questions. One is, as you say, what is it China's doing? But second, what is it that our challenges are? Where's our kind of master plan of the challenges, the problems that we face? How do we build up our own industries? And I think that that is a discussion that's happening right now in London, for sure. And it's happening in the US was happening under Trump a little bit. Now it's happening very aggressively under Biden, trying to work out how do we get the state to join up in the same way to compete with a Chinese system where the state is able to put itself into every single part of the system and business. And that's not how Western economies and democracies work. But I think we've got to work out how we do that. So, you know, the sale of streaming services has been blocked because, you know, every time you listen to something on Spotify or another music site, you're giving your geodata away. And at some point, that's a piece of data that has security implications and national security implications about who's listening to what, where, how, and so on. And I think we're trying to work out now what counts as security, what counts as things that need to be protected. And if you're going to protect, that means lower prices. So if you say we're not going to sell any apartments or football clubs to Chinese people, then you have to sell them to other people and for less, presumably.
I suppose we have different attitudes, don't we? I interviewed Will Storham a while ago about his book Selfies, and he pointed out in it that there's a difference of opinion between the West and the East. The East are all for the common good of the people, whereas the West are very much individuals. You know,
I don't believe that at all. Okay, so if you want to, and I can prove next time we meet in real life, we'll get on the tube in Shanghai. No one there is thinking about the common good. You know, like you first. It's the other way around. Here in Britain, you know, normally you tell someone to get in a queue, they'll do it. You know, so I think this idea that Eastern people are all like they obey the state, they all do it's all the kind of Orientalism where we're projecting ideas that people obey and do what they're told and they're all happy being bossed around. You know, that's absolute bollocks if you ask me. And equally, although it's true we're very good at individualism and selfishness and so on, there, you know, the way in which we give charitably, the way in which we're philanthropic, the way people raise money for good causes, you know, we have a very, very strong sense here of community in the West. And I think we can do ourselves down by thinking that we are in the West are defined by greedy hedge fund managers who just want to buy Bentleys and leave them outside Sloane Square tube station collecting parking tickets, and that defines us. And in China or Indonesia or Philippines, people just sit and nod along when someone powerful says do this. That's not what reality looks like to me in the lived world.
But we do seem to have quite a lot of those hedge fund type people, don't we?
But then we can fix that. That's about tax. That's about putting a structure in place. You know, at the moment, again, this week, we're talking about dropping caps.
Can we fix it? Because we've got globalization going on, which makes it really tough, doesn't it? With, you know, we're finding out with these companies running around the world avoiding their taxes.
Well, so Biden, that was one of the first things that Biden's tried to do is to have a global corporation tax. And the question is, how do you set that number at the right level? There's something called the Laffer curve, right, which is about tax, which is if you tax too high, people will avoid tax and pay accountants to find the legal way. If you pay too little, the government won't get their receipt. So you've got to put it at just the right amount that people won't bother to salt their cash away in Liechtenstein or Cayman Islands and to feel that they're getting good enough service. You know, in Sweden, Scandinavia, where I spend a lot of time, you know, tax there is 61%. You know, people pay that because they think the state delivers the services that it makes it worthwhile. And people who run away to Monaco or wherever it is, you know, they then get pilloried in society because they look like they've jumped ship to look after themselves. So I think that there are ways in which you can fix it, but it requires joined up government to do it. You need Western economies to all do the same thing. And the problem is if you don't, and you allow your financial services system, you allow the legal system to all work for oligarchs from whichever country they come from, and to beat the system and get paid really well to do it, then of course the house of cards comes tumbling down. So, I mean, ironically, we allow that to happen here. So we have a leaky system that doesn't help our citizens. And in other parts of the world, you know, you can't get away with it. And I think that that is a real challenge. And politicians don't understand it because they, by and large, haven't had jobs. They don't have the kind of skill sets that you need to attack that.
Yeah, they do come from the elite political class, though, don't they? So I'm sure they understand when the noughts are hitting their bank accounts that,
yours
joined up governments, which makes me laugh, considering our lot at the moment. But how's the internet changed things as well? What's fascinating, you know, we're talking about connections here and people interplaying. Again, going back to my daughters, they often quote American politics at me. And I'm like, what's it got to do with me? I live in Britain. It seems the lines are blurring a lot between Europe and America. And it was interesting when you said we earlier. My mind shifts constantly to America. And I feel we are sort of become one of their states, really, even though we're breaking away from Europe, we're breaking away from everything at the moment. How's the internet changed things? Is that spread of information?
It's a good, you know, you probably should get your daughters to come and answer that one. You know, it's about those identities. You know, again, growing up, the idea of traveling abroad, you know, that was very unusual. It was very rare. And now, you know, but before the pandemic anyway, people wouldn't think twice about jumping on an airplane to Thailand or wherever it might be. And that means that people's sense of home has changed a great deal. So again, you know, one of the kind of standout statements by any politician in the last 10 years was Theresa May saying, if you're a global citizen and a citizen of everywhere, you're a citizen of nowhere. And Trump played on that one as well to say, you know, Americans should be living at home, staying in America and not, you know, not traveling. And I think that sense of how do you control globalization? How do you stop people having their identity one thing or one way or another? You know, funnily enough, the most basic one is then hold an Olympics and a European football championships all the time. And you see everybody gets behind their sense of culture and identity much better than any politician can make you do. You know, we're cheering for GB in the Olympics or cheering for England in the Euros, you know, you get literally the entire country unites behind from every background, social class, ethnicity, gender, etc. And it's fantastic. So, you know, I think that there are ways in which in the kind of modern world, the internet allows us to gather information and to feel much more open about traveling, much less stressed about other people's backgrounds, much less judgmental. That's what all young people, you know, very open-minded, very, very keen to be tolerant and be respectful of people's choices. You know, that's what the generation after us all feel. And you can't help but admire that. I think it's just fantastic that they don't carry those prejudices. And when they do detect a prejudice, they're very quick to kind of want to talk it through and iron it out. And that's a real sign of sophistication, much more sophisticated than how the world we were all brought up in.
So America were the people who, in my mind, I don't know if the rest of the world saw this, but America are the ones who sit at the top of the table. When anything happens like the pandemic or anything like that, I mean, Trump mucked it up, but if Barack Obama was there, America would be the ones going, this is the way forward. This is how it feels like. They're the leaders of the free world, et cetera, et cetera. Is that changing now? Are we looking at a world where Russia are coming back into the game? China are, and India are working their way up. And then we've got the Middle East also. So are things changing in the world, in the league table of the world?
So, you know, I think when we go back through the pandemic, one of the great failures, and Neil Ferguson, the historian at Stanford, has pointed that out to me, is one of the great failures was the fact that the US, not just as the greatest economy, but as the greatest digital innovator, that those amazing tech companies in Silicon Valley didn't step in and solve the problems of contact tracing, of allowing you to work out where there were clusters of outbreaks. And we could have used these digital tools that, you know, we all have in smartphone-rich countries, you know, the developed world, in particular, to have worked out how to contain to contain the pandemic. And the reason why they didn't do it was that their lawyers wouldn't let them. They said, you're going to get sued to high heaven for breach of people's personal information. And the state, the Justice Department wouldn't give them a waiver to say, we won't come after you.
Wow. Right.
So it was partly Trump, et cetera, getting no question about that, making it much worse, confused messaging and disastrous. But looking back on it, what you and I would have said would be, don't employ some moron who's never done anything digital in their life and spend $40 billion trying to do contact tracing. Get the best in the world to do it, and they'll build it, you know, here now. And in fact, some of those tools they've got in existence already. But that was a kind of conspicuous failure, and that's to do with how capitalism works, that the ability to sue, the need to defend yourself in court, etc., all scared it away. So Silicon Valley should have played a lead role in all of this and should be playing a lead role for now and for the future. Now, it's obviously not that simple, otherwise the Chinese would have managed to do it, where they don't have the same kind of issues and challenges and problems. But, you know, again, earlier this week, Wuhan, where it all started, picked up a handful of cases, and they've shut the whole city down to test 9 million people in the space of the next 5 days. So, you know, things can happen quite quickly. But I think that in terms of, is the world changing? A lot will depend on how America sees itself, you know, and its self-perception. Does it see itself as a country that needs to dominate, or is threatened by the Chinese building more warships, for example? China, or the Chinese Navy already has more ships than the US Navy. Is that a bad thing? Does it matter where the Chinese ships are deployed or how they're being deployed? Does it matter if the Chinese are building roads and bridges here and there? And, you know, again, part of the work I do in places like West Africa, you know, the thing you hear time and time again is, stop telling us to not take money from China or get Chinese engineers to build airports, roads, train stations. Will you fund it? And, you know, we'll say, well, we can't afford it because we've got a pandemic in Britain. And, you know, people watching us will say, yes, but you've just laid everyone off on furlough. You spent 40 billion quid on a contact track and trace system that doesn't work. And you're telling us you don't have the cash. You've been paying people to sit at home, and the Chinese have got the cash and they want to lend to us. Could you come in as, you know, to join alongside them? And we say, well, we're cutting back our development aid budgets too. So part of the problem about that, those changes, is it a bad thing if states in Senegal or Angola have infrastructure that's been built by the Chinese? And if so, why is it bad? And if it's about debts, et cetera, well, we can help with all of that sort of side if we get off our backside and decide that it's in our interests to do it. But it's quite hard to be a global player when you're kind of pulling the curtains closed. So I think that a lot will depend on, does the US really feel threatened by the fact that other states are trying to rise? And by the way, this is not just about China, although that's the kind of headline. You know, the scale of growth and change in India and in Southeast Asia, you know, some of the biggest tech companies in the world, you know, I'd have thought all but a very small number of your listeners will never have heard of. You know, things like Gojek or Tokopedia in Indonesia are absolute monsters. You know, there's a monster super app in East Africa called M-Pesa that allows fintech stuff, you know, transfers of money, you know, etc., at blink of an eye, completely secure, crypto insured. And these are businesses that are worth tens of billions of dollars. Flipkart in India, where it's going to float for tens of billions of dollars. We never heard of them. So we're sitting here thinking, well, is it bad that the Chinese are building ships and, you know, they're up to no good and we shouldn't be selling our football clubs to them, which is all fair enough, right? But in the wider picture of what is happening right now, you know, there are a whole host of important questions we should be asking about those kind of global changes. Now, Indonesia, Philippines, India, Turkey, all between them, you know, we're already looking about 40% of the world's population, you know, and put China on top and we're above 50%. East of Istanbul, it's about 65% of the world's population. That's where climate change is going to either kill us all or be solved. It's not going to be whether we recycle more in Oxford. It's going to be, well, how do we get recycling in Delhi, Mumbai, clean water in Chinese cities and you know, stop pollution in Manila, and these cities have 30 million people in them. So I think that what do those questions, how do they involve us? And should we be involved because we've got expertise? Should we be involved because we're nice people? Or should we be involved because there are opportunities for us financially, politically, and so on? I think we've got to be asking those kinds of questions. Instead, I think we sit, a bunch of lecturers, academic lecturers, sit in a conference arguing about, is China a threat here, there, or whatever. The practical stuff is much more important, I think.
That's really interesting. And where do we sit in the world then? Obviously, we used to dominate the world once, as you mentioned earlier. We seem to be slipping further and further down. Is it a worry for us, or can we have some form of impact in world affairs?
I think education starts with everything. You know, I think that we in Britain, you know, we're pretty global in terms of how we think about things. You know, we're really engaged with, again, Olympics and World Cups and so on. You know, we're quite good at working out who everybody else is, and we follow, and we're very respectful, partly because we've got our own bittersweet past of that dominance, you know, that came at other people's cost. But we've in some cases have worked out how to recognize we've got an obligation to deal with some of those kind of legacies of colonialism, of empire, of expropriation, and so on. And I think, you know, we haven't done that as well as we could do, but, you know, there are noises that we try. And so I think that some of it is about making sure young people understand that big global picture. you know, I did a kids version of, or younger readers version of The Silk Road, so that younger readers can, you know, don't get intimidated by a longer book, but could sort of get kicking off in school to think about those questions we started with about religions. You know, are they always bad? What are the good stuff that they can bring, and how do they spread anyway? What is it that, if you're looking for a religious answer, what is the question you're asking in the first place? And I think that that education makes a difference. The problem is here, we don't spend any time thinking about other people's histories. We don't learn their languages. We're very good at watching our Premier League, but actually we don't even watch other European leagues, really, let alone, you know, what's happening in other parts of the world. So, you know, Oscar, one of the best Chelsea players the last 15 years, sold out to a team in China. And, you know, we're very bad at paying attention to other people's achievements, to other people, what they're doing. You know, so the highest grossing movie in the world last year was a Chinese film. That, you know, we should be making our kids, and I do that with my children, for every 5 of their songs we have to listen to, they've stretched that out a bit. You know, I make them listen to some Turkish rap or, you know, some
wow, South Korean, what's that like?
Chinese, Russian hip hop. And I've always told them, I don't mind if you don't like it. And I don't mind if you really don't like it, but I expect you to explain why you don't like it, right?
I love that.
Listen to this stuff. It's going to take you 2 minutes. Then we'll put Billie Eilish back on. Absolutely fine. Or whatever you want to listen to. But this is what other people are listening to your age in the world, as well as listening to, you know, the same stuff that we're all listening to. But, you know, last year there were, I think it's something like 100 million downloads of South Korean music in Peru. You know, so other people are paying attention to what's going on. You know, South Korean soap operas are huge all over the world. But, you know, apart from Parasite, the Oscar-winning film, you know, no one here watches any of that stuff. So it just means that when you meet people to do business or to find solutions, you're in the blind, and your assumption is they know a lot about you because they've watched, you know, Yes Minister, everyone from other parts of the world, they sent their kids to schools here, they, you know, they watch our football, they're able to talk to you, but we're not able to engage on equal terms. And that looks to me like a sense of entitlement. So
that's fantastic. Where would you find these things though? Where do you locate what's popular in other people's countries? Just Googling it online, is it?
It's not hot. And I mean, yeah, that's like I said, young people are very, very resourceful, much more resourceful than me. And in fact, again, with my
students, what about my listeners? They're not that young. So,
well, you know, that's a phrase. You go to any streaming site and you put Turkish top 10, you know, Russian top 10. So, you know, South Asia, you know, find what people are listening to in Lahore today. And, you know, what's, you know, tune into a radio station in Manila. And are they playing Justin Bieber? Are they playing Sheryl Crow? Are they playing stuff that we know? And that's interesting in its own right.
Interesting. Can I ask you another question, which before we run out of time here, which is something which fascinates me. I'm really big on drug reform. I think it's one of the big problems we've got in this country, the prohibition, drug prohibition. And hopefully just today in the papers, Scotland look like they're going to be doing something for offering good clean clinics for heroin, because they've got such a problem with it over there. In your book, it's amazing talking about the poppy fields and heroin, opium fields and stuff in the Middle East, and how it's funding the Taliban. One of the arguments has always been with drug reform, if you legalize it, then if they're going to have to start selling that stuff around the world, they've got to legalize themselves. And if that happens, then they might not be able to fund these organizations. How, by the way, I just want to read the fact here of it. It says how much, to put it in perspective, the equivalent of more than 400,000 US football fields is being grown in Afghanistan at the moment. I mean, that is an incredible amount, isn't it? And what do you think on this? Is that right? Do you think is the heroin, is the poppy fields, are they huge in the Middle East? Are they important? Are they influential?
That's in Afghanistan. Well, you know, there are three ways you can fix it. One is you let the market solve it, you know, so you could buy that entire crop at whatever the price would be, and you do what you like. In fact, when the US Army arrived in 2001, they burnt all the fields, and they said to all the Afghan farmers, you know, you should grow other stuff like cotton, or, you know, try wheat, or maybe rice, or stuff that, A, they didn't have experience. Sometimes they weren't ecologically appropriate, but also they made less money for them than the poppies. So you can solve that in a different way. The problem is, if you're the single buyer, goes, guys, you grow your 400,000 football fields worth of opium, you can bet your bottom dollar next year there'll be 800,000 fields of people wanting to sell to you too. But I think legalization is obviously a way in which you can handle it also, and dealing with contamination, which is obviously a big problem in Scotland. It's the drugs themselves being dangerous rather than just the amount of users you have. That can be also part of it. And then you can have less enlightened ways of doing it, which is to kind of turn your eye and pretend it doesn't happen. But if people in the streets of Glasgow are dying, as these reports have said in gruesome detail, then the source of where that all comes from is really important. And for some reason, and it's the same with Colombia, it's been the same with drugs in Mexico. If you would think that after 30 years of having bad results, you might try and change the way in which you set about dealing with things. And maybe that doesn't work either. Maybe it makes things even worse. But I'd have thought that there's got to be a case for trying to find ways to let enlightened interventions into drug policy, where the state has a very strong interest in keeping things as clean and as secure as possible, putting out of business cartels and all the nasty stuff that goes with it, that comes at an additional huge cost. You know, it's not just people dying from overdoses, it's the way in which the drugs reach the front door in the first place. You know, there's bodies along the whole supply chain. That would seem to me a more effective way of doing it. But for all sorts of reasons, politicians seem to think that it's a vote loser to talk in terms of drug legalization. Yeah. And, you know, we haven't been as enlightened as perhaps other states have. But I know that there are lots of experiments in particularly places like the Netherlands, where people do things in a different kind of way. There in the Netherlands, if you're a user, people, you know, there's no social prior pressure on you, that things have worked in a slightly different way. But it's the first thing that gets through with populist leaders is to victimize minorities. And that's the same for ethnic groups, that's the same for religious groups, and it's the same for excluded groups like drug users, who find themselves a convenient way of projecting all the ills of society rather than a more honest approach, I think, to how this could be dealt with.
Yeah, any of you listening to this are interested, Neil Woods talks, I've done a couple of podcasts with him. Just look up on wherever you're getting your podcast from, and you can hear all his views on it. He used to be a plainclothes copper in the drug squad, and he talks a lot about it. Peter, thank you so much for joining me. How's your podcast going?
Yeah, great. I've been listening with me, Peter Frankopan. It's great. I've had Ai Weiwei. I had the Chinese artist dissident, who was great. Jim Comey, who was head of the FBI, who basically shaped the 2016 result of the election. He came on and we talked about how he was called in to see Trump in 2017 when he's head of the FBI. And Trump said to him over dinner, he said, "I want your loyalty." And he said, "I'm going to enforce the law. I've sworn an oath to Lady Justice," and so on. And he went, "I want to know that you're going to be loyal. I'm going to give you 20 seconds to think about it." And he said it was like a deer about to be hit by a car. You know, his entire life went in front of him, of thinking, you know, all those, that degree, all the work I've done putting criminals behind the bar, and I'm now being asked, will I back this guy against the law, and you know, so on. And then I had Will Page, who's the chief economist of Spotify, who was great, who said, you know, "You two wouldn't function today. Where the streets have their name, no name, Bono doesn't sing for 2 minutes and 9 seconds. Now with Spotify and other hosting services, you get paid at the 30-second mark. So you need to have the chorus first, and it needs to be catchy to start with, because over the 31-second mark, doesn't matter anymore. So you make your songs short, you make the punchy, you put the chorus, verse, rather than the other way around. And, you know, that you know, it's fascinating talking to interesting people about, well, like you do, about the what's going on in the world, and getting insights into things that you didn't necessarily always think about. So very kind of you to mention it. But yeah, I've been thinking with Peter Frankopan. It's been great. I'm really enjoying it.
Yeah, I love these sort of conversations. They're fantastic. Well, thank you so much, Peter. Thanks for joining me today.
Pleasure. Thanks, Tim.